I'm John Kroll. Today on No Limits, we're going to do a close examination of the environmental controversy in Franklin, Indiana. Residents, particularly children, in that town have shown higher than normal rates of cancer, and reports have indicated alarming levels of toxins in elementary schools. My guests will include members of families affected, investigators, and the reporter who has covered the issue closely. Please join the conversation. Call 866-476-3881. Email nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi or track us down on Twitter at wfyi. Now, this news. Welcome to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StatehouseFile.com, and your host. We're going to be talking today about the environmental controversy in Franklin, Indiana. If you want to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. You can find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi, or you can track us down on Twitter at wfyi. My guests are Carrie Reinhardt and Stacy Davidson from the grassroots group If It Was Your Child, Director of Land Cleanup and Waste Management Program Evaluations Tina Lovingood, and Project Manager Jill Trinosky, both of whom are with the EPA Office of Inspector General, and Indiana Public Broadcasting Environmental Reporter Rebecca Thiel. Welcome to all of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks.
It's good to have you here. I probably should do what I'm guessing would be a self-evident disclosure, because I am the director of the Pulliam School of Journalism at Franklin College. I spend a lot of time in Franklin, Indiana, and in case anybody really, really, really cares, I actually lived there when I was a child and went to one of the two elementary schools that was in the news recently, many, 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 many years ago. So I want to start because, and I should say to the audience and everyone, because this is a kind of complicated story and we've got a lot of people here, I may take a slightly more active hand in the discussion and step in to make sure that people understand exactly what is being said, because the scientific issues are somewhat complicated. Also, keeping the narrative straight can be a little bit complicated. So I'm going to start with Rebecca here. Mm-hmm. And ask you, as the storyteller in this panel, to sort of bring us up to date where things are right now and how we got to this point.
Well, basically, Carrie and Stacy with If It Was Your Child have both had experiences like several parents in Franklin having kids with rare cancers. A couple of parents got together, noticed these rare cancers happening in Franklin, and thought, what's going on here? Suspected that maybe there could be chemicals from the old Amphenol industrial waste site, spreading contamination around and making people sick.
And when did this, I'll throw it to either Carrie or Stacy, whichever one, when did you first begin to notice this, or when did you begin to think, okay, there could be a problem here?
So Zane, my stepson, was diagnosed with acute lymphoblastic leukemia June 3rd, 2014. And while we were going through treatment, we started meeting a lot of families from Johnson County when he was an inpatient or going in for outpatient chemo. And actually, within 16 months after Zane was diagnosed, 9 more children were diagnosed with cancer in Johnson County, several from Franklin. And so that's kind of when the light bulb went off, and I knew that there was something else going on besides just bad luck, which we have been always told. So I contacted local media, Sandra Chapman with WTHR, and she took this investigation on, and that's when we actually found that there was so many points of interest and industries and companies that have had issues with contamination in Franklin that we actually weren't even privy to. So that's how it all came about, and that's how I met Carrie.
And Carrie, why don't you tell us how you became involved here?
Well, in September of 2014, my oldest daughter, Emma, was diagnosed with a rare brain tumor called glioblastoma. It's the John McCain brain tumor. Mm-hmm. It's older men are found to have those, and it was incredibly rare. And we weren't sure why. Obviously, we didn't really have time to evaluate why, because Emma died 3 months and 13 days after she was diagnosed.
I am sorry.
Thank you. And then that's when Stacy started talking to all the families and contacted us and started asking questions, and we got involved that way. And I lived next to the schools and right on top of everything for 11 years, 12 years almost, and I never even heard of it. I didn't know the Webb Well Field was a EPA Superfund. I didn't, you know, all of these things that you would think you would hear about. Just never.
Oh yeah, having grown up in Franklin, that was considered one of the nice, if not, nicer neighborhoods.
Absolutely.
In Franklin, the place where you considered yourself safe. So when let's jump forward to when did you start the group? If it was your child.
Actually, it was pretty organic how it began, because after we met with Sandra Chapman, there was about 9 or 10 families that met that night, and we all started talking. And Sandra definitely led us in a direction how we needed to go. But as parents, you're trying to find out how you can help your child, how to protect your child, because at this point, that's been taken away from you. So we started meeting, parents started meeting at the Franklin Pizza King in the back room, trying to figure out what avenue to go, how we were going to get testing done because it was so expensive, and who we needed to contact. And one of the parents in the group, someone in Franklin at one point said to her, "Do you know what you're doing? Do you know how this is going to affect business and how this is going to affect the economy with how you're talking about the cancer in Franklin?" And she came back with, "What if it was your child?" And so that's how it began, and it just took off, and we just kept that name. And then my husband made a Facebook page, and we kind of just went from there. And we thought about changing the name at some point last year when we became a 501, but it's stuck, and everybody knows us in this way, so it's easier.
So Tina and Jill, could you talk a bit about you know, what are the environmental concerns here and the history of that area?
So this is Tina. So the environmental concerns are something we're referring to EPA to discuss, and we are talking about our work, which is to look at how EPA is communicating about those risks to the public.
And do we, I mean, can we talk about what it is that, you know, there's a reference here to it being a cleanup site and all of that. What is the history of that area that might have produced these conditions? Tina or Jill?
Hi, this is Jill.
Hi, Jill.
So I just want to kind of roll us back a little bit since
okay.
Tina and I haven't had a chance to be introduced on the program yet. And I just wanted to explain kind of where we're coming from within the Environmental Protection Agency. So Tina and I actually work within an independent office of the Inspector General. It's part of the EPA, but we are separate in the sense that our funding is separate, and we do not report directly through the same channels that the EPA does. So we do have independence from the EPA itself. And our work involves looking at the EPA and whether or not they're following policies and procedures, and if, you know, if there's areas where they can be more effective and efficient in the way they do their work. So we are coming in to look at this particular site in terms of how well EPA has communicated with the public at this site. We're looking at whether the EPA has communicated, for example, sampling results or any other indicators of human health risk at this site in a manner that has allowed the public to take precautions or avoid exposure to harmful contaminants or substances where they need to. So this is one of 8 different sites nationwide that we're taking a closer look at to see if we have recommendations for how EPA might better communicate with the public. So in terms of the contamination at the site, that's definitely one of the reasons why we're looking at this site, because it is in one of EPA's contaminated site programs. The EPA itself, in through Region 5 and the technical experts that are working there, and they've done a lot of work on the site so far, you know, I would refer anybody to their office and to those professionals as far as issues related to the cleanup and where they are. They have, you know, websites available with the status of their work at the Amphenol and Franklin PowerPoint that talks about kind of the background at the site. And they talk about the investigations that they're doing on the release of VOCs or volatile organic compounds at the site and some of the different testing that they have done.
So you cannot speak to then the contamination per se. You can only address the question of whether the EPA communicated effectively with the people who might be affected, might have been affected. Is that a correct summary?
Right. So that's the focus of our work. And as part of our work, we'll be looking at what the contamination at the site is and whether EPA was communicating that in a timely and effective manner to the public. But in terms of talking in specifics about the contaminants itself, that's better. We would say, you know, that would be something that I think the technical experts at EPA would be the best ones to go to for those types of questions.
Rebecca, you look like you want to say something.
I think that what you're getting at here is what kinds of contaminants are we talking about?
Yes.
We are talking about primarily TCE and PCE. That is an acronym, and I'm not going to tell you the full names of those.
Go ahead, Carrie.
But just to avoid confusion, but those are, I believe that they've been labeled as carcinogens, cancer-causing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that's kind of what we're basically talking about here. They are volatile organic compounds. Hopefully I've said that correctly, which means that we can find these in the air. We can find these in the water. We could find them in the soil. It really does not have a boundary to one particular type of, water, air, soil, anything like that.
Okay. So it sounds like at least one of the issues here, and I'll throw this first to carry, that is a source of contention, is how much information was available to the families that were living in the area. Could you speak to that? Were you aware?
Well, I would say,
at what point did you become aware?
I became aware of the actual Amphenol site in 2015 with the media report. I lived virtually on the Webb Well field and within a half a mile less of the Amphenol site. I'd never even heard of Amphenol. I had no idea what it was, and I'm a news junkie. I went to Franklin College on a journalism scholarship, so I should have seen or heard when the EPA made the Webb Well field a Superfund site. In fact, not only did I not know, the city officials we met with 2 years ago did not know they had a Superfund site in their city. That's a problem.
Stacy, and just to close the circle here, were you aware? And when did you become aware?
It was about the same time. Zane lived in Franklin for 5 years with his mom, and we had no idea. So this all came about when Sandra Chapman did that story. And when that story first came out, of all the documents that she found and the holes that she found in this whole background of Franklin Power Products and the Webb Well field, that's when we found out. And that's what's hard for us, I think, is that there's been so many, as you dig deeper, there's been so many discrepancies and so many holes of data not done, not posted. And so that's when I found out too. And so it's very frustrating to know that there's an environmental issue that can affect human health in such a way, but no one in the town necessarily knew, or people that are really right on top of that site had no idea. So when you go to those people and you talk to those people and say, did you know? And you can throw a rock at these industries and these businesses, and they look at you and say, I don't know what you're talking about. That's a problem.
And John, this
yes.
is Tina. This is exactly what we need to hear. This is exactly the kind of feedback we need to hear. We need to understand what EPA is doing really well, but we also need to understand, you know, where the challenges are so that we can make recommendations on how EPA can improve risk communication to the public in the future.
If you are just joining us, we are talking about the environmental controversy down in Franklin, Indiana. My guests are Kerry Reinhart and Stacy Davidson from the grassroots group If It Was Your Child, Director of Land Cleanup and Waste Management Program Evaluations Tina Lovingood, and Project Manager Jill Trinosky, both with the EPA Office of Inspector General, and Indiana Public Broadcasting Environmental Reporter Rebecca Field. If you want to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. Send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. Or track us down on social media. I'm John Kroll. You're listening to No Limits. Please, stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StatehouseFile.com, and your host. We're talking about the environmental controversy down in Franklin, Indiana, today on No Limits. My guests are Kerry Reinhart and Stacy Davidson from the grassroots group If It Was Your Child, Director of Land Cleanup and Waste Management Program Evaluations Tina Lovingood, and Project Manager Jill Trinosky, both with the EPA Office of Inspector General, and Indiana Public Broadcasting Environmental Reporter Rebecca Thiel. So before we went to the break, Tina and Jill, both Stacy and Kerry said that they before members of their family had been stricken by cancer, they were not aware of any of this, and that in fact city officials were not aware of the background. There is that proper EPA procedure. I mean, one would think that it, at the very least, city officials should have been aware of it.
John, this is one of the questions that we need to get further into. We need to understand a little bit more about why EPA might not have communicated the risk to the local folks, and we need to understand what the breakdown was in communication there, and if the communication was followed as required, then we need to understand why the folks that live closest to it didn't know. And so we need to understand that. We don't understand that right now.
How far are you in your investigation? At what point, I mean, have you been able to establish that communications were sent out from the EPA?
We are in the very earliest stages of our review in what we call preliminary research. And it's an early time in our review where we seek to gain background information to understand whether the question or the objective that we're looking at is in fact the right one. And so we're going to as many as four sites in addition to the Franklin site to hear from communities to understand a little bit better about risk communication and where, again, EPA may be doing well, but where it may also need to make some improvements. And so as we continue on, we'll issue what we call a draft and a final report. And right now, our final report is expected late this calendar year.
Where are the other four sites that you're
So we are
at?
in the process of finalizing the other site selections and notifying the communities that are relevant here. So it would be improper for me to say what they are before those communities themselves know.
Rebecca.
And I wanted to see if you could confirm this or not. Kerry and Stacy on their Facebook group mentioned that Franklin was going to be the first site that the OIG was visiting in this effort. Is that true? And if so, why?
That is true, and it just happened to be the first of the four that we went to. We, for scheduling reasons and location, we chose to do it first. We chose the eight sites based on four of them based on research that we had done by looking at public records to see where EPA had communicated risk to communities. And we also had hotline referrals on some sites, and so that's a factor also in our selection of the sites. And then for the other four sites that we selected, we asked EPA for sites that it thought it had done well in risk communication. And so we have these eight sites that we're looking at, and the four sites that we plan to go to, two of them are, again, agency selected or recommended to us, and then two are ones we chose. And the Amphenol site is one that we chose.
What? Let me take a step back on this. Presuming that you're investigating some place where the process broke down here, what should the process have been? Does the EPA have a process for informing communities and residents that they might be at some risk? And what would that process be normally?
So we're studying what that's called criteria to us. We're studying that criteria to better understand what the requirements are and whether EPA, you know, would have followed them. So we're still, again, we're early in our preliminary research trying to understand all of that. And so I can't really speak to it at this point. I'm sorry.
But I'm just curious. You mean there isn't a protocol in place then that the EPA is supposed to follow?
Oh, there is. We're just trying to understand and study what that protocol is. There's several different guidance documents that EPA has, and
So, Stacy, you want to say something? I want to ask: has anyone told you what that protocol might have been or should have been? What have your contacts been like with the EPA?
Few, I guess. I think one of the most frustrating things for us as parents and actually starting out with this is that as we've looked in and dug through tens of thousands of documents that we've provided FOIA requests through, we realize...
And I should say for those of us who don't speak
journalism... I'm sorry.
Freedom of Information
That
Act.
Was like one of the things that I'm supposed to do.
Yeah,
I apologize.
No, that's why I'm here. Okay.
Right. But back in the 80s, Amphenol was actually, the hazard risk score was so high that it could have been deemed a Superfund site at that time. But through the businesses saying, okay, we'll self-report, we'll keep checking on this kind of thing, knowing they had a problem. But one of the problems is that the pump and treat system on the property was not even placed until 1995. So you found out in 1984 that it could have been a Superfund site, and we waited 11 years to actually start fixing the problem. 11 years to put a pump and treat on that Amphenol site to try and protect the people there and the people around. Now come to find out that there should have been a scrubber filter put on top of the stack on the pump and treat, so as the water comes in to get treated, the volatiles will rise, and that scrubber filter is supposed to be put on top to contain. That was never put on top in 1995. So they just put that on in August of 2018, just last year, when we started our own testing. So these are some of the things that we are so frustrated about, because you start getting these pages and this information, and you start seeing these data gaps. Mm. And even back in the 80s, they did a theoretical analysis stating, you know what, these people on Forsyth Street, they may be affected. They may be at risk from this site. Mm. And guess what? No data, no field data was ever done, ever, to say that. So now when the EPA did come back last year, that plume that they identified as the Amphenol plume goes along with that theoretical analysis that they said could happen back in the 80s. So we're talking three decades that if they would have done analysis and data, they could have caught that. How many more people are affected because 30 years went by without even trying to figure out if that theoretical analysis is correct? And that's one of the things that is so frustrating.
Carrie, I want you to speak to what your contacts have been as well.
Most recently, the contact has been frustrating. So we started last summer before even our first sampling event with a a change.org petition, and we ended up with over 40,000 signatures on that. And we still didn't hear from anyone until well after the data had been released from the first Mundell study that showed these levels were insane and they were in people's home and in the ambient air. And then, of course, there's been emails and whatnot, but before there was any kind of public forum, that was November 28th of 2018. Our test results came out July 16th of 2018. So we went from July until November knowing that this is happening in homes on this small sampling that we did, knowing that if a small sampling showed it, that a larger one would. I would say it's frustrating because the meeting was in November was more about us sitting and listening to what they had to tell us. There was no meaningful communication. This is not two-way communication. When we have requested a CAG, a community advisory group, we've been shot down for that and just flat not responded to. We had the actual EPA community liaison in a smaller group meeting afterwards curse at a prominent community member who asked a perfectly legitimate question. She's a doctor. She asked a perfectly legitimate question.
What was the question?
I don't even remember.
Was,
I think
it was about it was bringing the gaps together about the CAG. So the EPA did not want to do the CAG for this site because
community
they're
advisory group.
Right. Sorry. Yeah. I'm getting an F on that.
Carrie had already had walked us through the acronym a second ago.
Oh, okay. Sorry.
As well.
Anyway.
So that's okay.
Yeah. Yeah. So she was basically just talking about how do we make this, how do we fill in the gap between the environmental portion and the health assessment and the health risk. As a doctor, I have seen, you know, renal cell cancer and TCE is known to cause renal cell. Where does EPA and the community come together on that? ATSDR, the health department, how does that work? And something about her question put him off. And the next thing I know, this man is cursing, and I'm sitting in the high school where I should be watching my daughter graduate from, and a building I never got to take her into. And this is how my community is being treated.
Yeah, and he, I mean, that was a low point because he was actually bringing his own personal issues into the situation, and he actually looked at this community member and said, I don't know what you're talking about. I'm not being wishy-washy. I had cancer, too. It just inappropriate things. And that's what we've dealt with. I mean, we had a meeting scheduled the day of, like a few hours before the community meeting, to discuss more specific things. And they canceled on us
an hour before.
Yeah. I mean, there's just things like this that we are trying so hard to, as we ask for transparency, we absolutely 100% give that. And when we are giving that and giving our information and what we have, and we're getting pushback in return, that's what's frustrating. Or if you're going to bring a community member or a liaison to this community and say, I hope you guys know that I'm a lawyer, and if anyone's thinking of suing, I'll sue you right back. I mean, just very aggressive behavior for a community that is just trying to get this cleaned up. That's all we want, is to get this cleaned up. So just interactions like that that are just very frustrating. And I don't think that Carrie or I or anybody else in the community should have to deal with that when we're coming to a meeting to listen and to talk.
If you are just joining us, we are talking about the environmental controversy in Franklin, Indiana. If you want to join the conversation, you can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi. Track us down on Twitter at WFYI, or do what a listener named Mary Ann has done and give us a call at 866-476-3881. Mary Ann, you're on the air.
Oh, hi. I have a question. I moved to Indiana from another state, and where I used to live, Superfund sites were listed in the real estate records. They were made note of on the tax roll. If you went to buy or sell a property, your abstract of title would show that. And I don't know if that was a state law there that Indiana doesn't have. Would anyone on this panel know?
Well, I sold my property.
Thanks very much for the call and the question, Mary Ann. We'll try to get you an answer. Go ahead, Carrie.
2011, late 2011, and I know there was nothing in the closing about that particular, there was nothing about a Superfund site or any contamination issues that I ever recall us having to discuss.
Is that, Jill and Tina, is this, I mean, obviously you examine this primarily from the perspective of federal law and the Environmental Protection Agency, but is there any variation in the way states approach these things?
So this is Jill. I can't speak to state-by-state how things work, but I can say that in addition to the sources that Mary Ann talked about, there are Clean Up in Your Community websites and different ways that you can try to find information on what type of contamination there might be in your community. So I think the suggestion to kind of look into things and see what's available is an excellent one, and, you know, understanding that sometimes there's limitations to what is out there, and that seems to be what's coming up today, that there have been, you know, to some of the participants on here, there may have been some limitations to what was available.
We've also heard from a listener via Twitter, and again, if you want to join the conversation via Twitter, you can find us at WFYI. This listener writes, I grew up in Franklin and left when I was about 20. But ever since I first heard this story a while ago, I've been reluctant to move back, despite it being much closer to my job. It's a little concerning that this has taken so long to investigate. Is it really safe to come back? I don't know who wants to answer that one. I guess probably Jill and Tina, I can anticipate the disclaimer, obviously, that you are not an EPA. You know, you're not investigating levels of contamination. Is there a place they can go, people can go, to get an answer on that question about the safety, and how should they go about doing that?
So one of the things that is on the Cleanups in My Community website that Jill spoke about a moment ago is whether or not the human health indicators, whether they're under control, meaning that there's evidence that human health is protected and whether groundwater migration is protected. And those are indicators on for each site that anyone can look up.
So that would be the place, and the URL for that again is?
You would just search on Cleanups in My Community.
Cleanups in My Community, Google search it.
Correct.
We've gotten an email from a listener named Sonia, and again, if you want to join the conversation via email, you can do so at nolimits@wfyi.org. Sonia writes, how is the EPA communicating with those who live there in the 80s, 90s, and early 2000s, but now live elsewhere? Is there any attempt to do that, and is that part of the protocol? Jill or Tina, in the early stages of your investigation, are you finding that there have been attempts at all to reach people who lived in Franklin during an era when this might have been in play but have since left?
That's something we really haven't looked at this point, but it is an interesting question. You know, how far back does the EPA go? How far back do they need to go? It's certainly an interesting question and something we're looking at in the sites that we're reviewing in terms of, you know, what is the timeline at the site? What's the timeline for the communication? So I don't know how far back they're going, but it's an interesting question.
And, you know, with this investigation, again, you say that that the report probably will be out by the end of this calendar year, by December 31, 2019?
Yes. That's correct.
Okay. If you are just joining us, we are talking about the environmental controversy in Franklin, Indiana. We're talking with just about everyone who has been touched with it and is trying to deal with that situation right now. If you would like to join the conversation, there are several ways you can do that. You can call us at 866-476-3881. You can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. You can find us on Facebook at No Limits WFYI, or you can track us down on Twitter at WFYI. I'm John Krall. You're listening to No Limits. Please, stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Krall, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StatehouseFile.com, and your host. We're talking about the environmental controversy in Franklin, Indiana, today on No Limits. My guests are Kerry Reinhart and Stacey Davidson from the grassroots group If It Was Your Child, director of Land Cleanup and Waste Management Program Evaluations, Tina Lovingood and project manager Jill Trinosky, both with the EPA Office of Inspector General, and Indiana Public Broadcasting environmental reporter Rebecca Thiel. If you want to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org, find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi, or track us down on Twitter at wfyi. So, Jill and Tina, I want to ask, you know, since we're looking at a wrap-up of this investigation in approximately 7 months, within the next 7 months, where does the process go from here? What things are you going to be looking at?
We're, again, going to go to approximately three other sites, four in total, and we're also looking at closely at four additional sites to see how EPA has communicated risk. One thing I did want to add, earlier we mentioned that the report was planned for December of 2019, but one thing we do have an option on and we always look for is if there is some immediate concern that we need to pass along to EPA right away, we do that through a management alert. So it's possible it's a special report that we put out, and so we do have the option of doing that, and if we find something of immediate concern, we would report it much more timely than December of 2018.
What sorts of things would rise to the level of being an immediate concern?
So typically, if there's something that either impacts the human health risk or the accuracy of information or the transparency of information that might be important to the public to know more timely than our normal processes would allow, we issue a management alert, and then we continue our work as we answer whatever objective that we're assigned to do.
And just so we're clear, when you say an immediate health risk, what sorts of things, can you give me an example of what that might be? Or what one has been in the past?
Well, we issued recently a management alert regarding the toxics release inventory and how that public data, which is a summary of all of the reports across the country of releases of hazardous chemicals, it goes into the toxics release inventory. And one of the things that we found is that when communities or anybody who drew data down from that website found inaccurate data, and when they looked for certain certain types of releases from publicly owned treatment works facilities or, you know, your sewage treatment plants. And so we reported out on that so that the public who was relying on that data to do research, or if you're a community member near that facility, you need to know that the data that you're getting from that database was inaccurate. And so we issued a management alert on that, and EPA, according to EPA, it made corrections to that database. So that's one thing we wanted to make sure the public was aware of.
Stacey, I could see you wanted to jump in and say something.
Yeah, I mean, I just have a question for either one of you. We have at least one homeowner that lives on Forsyth, and last weekend, they were doing, IWM was doing work via EPA, via Amphenol, on the sewers. And those broke, and the water flooded into this person's basement. This is kind of twofold. So she brought IWM into her home and asked them, do we need to do any more testing? Because, you know, I have water in my basement, and the pump and treat, as we find out, on Amphenol site had been turned off. And they said no. So, and then my other point was, she recently gave me the results of her testing done in February, or in March, I'm sorry, after a mitigation system was already placed in January, because they found high numbers of volatiles in her home. And the sewer cleanout numbers for the March testing of her home after the mitigation system was placed, for PCE, it was almost 900. And for TCE, it was almost 400. No communication has been given to her as that's a problem.
Stacy, to step in, what are acceptable, or anyone here, what are acceptable levels for
well,
PCE
and I think that's what makes it hard for, I think, correct me, 75, I believe, or does Indiana not have?
For soil, yeah.
No, for
so different
sewer.
Things. You have sewer,
right?
You have levels for the sewer, levels for the soil, levels for the groundwater. So it gets very confusing. I believe for the ambient air, it's 42 for PCE. So we're if
sewer cleanout, yeah,
yeah. So but the sewer cleanout ends up in your ambient air, because when you flush the toilet, if the vapors get back up into your house, then you're breathing them. I think this is a perfect example of where our community members have reached out to us to get answers, and it's required us to beg for answers, basically say, why is this happening? To me, it's an immediate environmental concern. If the pump and treat is turned off,
right,
and these people's homes are being flooded with water, groundwater that is passing through contaminated soil, it also has not been treated, then their homes are being flooded with TCE and PCE and vinyl chloride and other volatiles. So these are things, how no one is telling this poor woman that she needs this muck in her basement that came from this site, because that's where the groundwater flows from. It cuts directly through that site. No one is walking into her house and saying, this is an immediate environmental concern for these people. And she's asking the only people she even knows to ask, which is a private company. That doesn't, you know, telling us that we need to send people, refer people to a website to find out if they have contamination. Does this mean every time you have a home, you buy a home, you move, you have to go Google to make sure you're safe and assume the information is correct?
Right.
Rebecca, so far we've been focusing on the EPA, but the state's been involved in this discussion too, correct?
That's correct. And correct me if I'm wrong here, ladies, but IDEM was really the Indiana Department of Environmental Management was really the first agency that you got in contact with, correct?
And I should step in here and say representatives from IDEM were invited to appear on the program, and they declined the invitation.
Yeah, and I'm sad that they're not here. But, yeah, wasn't that who you first got in contact with in terms of the
site? We had first – the first responses we had immediately after our first Mundell test was from the Indiana Department of Environmental Management. But that was a contentious process. We had homeowners who had 18 times higher than you can have for a dry cleaning business has PCE – can only have PCE at a certain level. Their level in their home was 18 times higher. They had a risk assessor come into their home and pull a dry cleaned coat out of the closet and said, this is why. This is one dry cleaned item in your home is why your level is 18 times more.
And this is not, unfortunately, and I've reported on a couple of Superfund sites, this is unfortunately not unusual for a state agency to take this kind of tactic because they don't want to be alarmist. But unfortunately, and there's funding also plays into this as well, and we could have a whole conversation about IDEM and the lack of funding for some of these kinds of projects and cleanups. But, you know, it's very touch and go. These state agencies, they don't want to be alarmist, but then again, you know, these are real problems that people are experiencing, and they want answers.
We've gotten a tweet, and again, if you want to join the conversation via Twitter, you can do so at WFYI. That's on point. One listener wrote, this is a prime example of what happens when you deregulate. I feel bad for those families, but you vote for people who are pro-deregulation. A, that they're making assumptions about, obviously, which way you voted.
Correct.
And as far as we know. But I think, to be fair to the listener, probably talking about Indiana having a much more laissez-faire,
right,
libertarian view of government's role than some other states would have.
Yeah.
Which got to Mary Ann's point earlier, which is,
right,
in other states, all of this stuff has to be listed. There is,
sure,
right.
It's really hard to, I mean, we have been through the gamut as far as the political point of view and Republicans and Democrats. And the thing is that we have to remember is that when we're, it's very hard because when you start saying, oh, because we've heard it, it's a Republican county, and so this does happen and stuff like that. But we have to remember that these are children, these are people, and it doesn't matter what side of the aisle you're on. It doesn't, you know, no candidate is perfect. And I think that we need to have compassion and work together no matter what, instead of kind of making that divide as far as the deregulation and the sides that we're on, which I completely understand it. We get it. We're working on it on a federal level as well.
So let me, I've pressed Jill and Tina on a couple of things. It's probably only fair that what do you want from the EPA and from IDEM right now that would address your concerns? Because it would seem like that's a good way to get to the problem-solving phase of this discussion.
The biggest thing for me is the schools. So the schools recently closed down for a day because they had high results come back. And it was disturbing because in August, they tested after we did, because some of our results were close to those schools. Mm-hmm. They did the right thing. And then And a state risk assessor came in and said, you're good, you don't need to test anymore. And that is completely polar opposite of what their own policy and the EPA's own policy says. So the school is being guided by a state that wants to guide them away from a precautionary principle to take all steps to make sure things are safe. My thing for the EPA, and I asked this in November at the EPA meeting, is these contaminants have now been found across the city and as far as a mile and a half away in high levels, in detectable levels, and yet the only investigation area is still this small map directly south of the Amphenol site. So if the kids in the school are sitting on top of this, how are we not moving quicker to expand this investigation? And no one has given us the answer to that. So in the meantime, the community is reaching out to us asking, do I send my kids to school? That's a very difficult question to answer when you have two rounds of testing to look at. And everyone knows those two rounds are nowhere near a complete picture. So we need the EPA to come in with the ability to take this investigation on a broader scale and address, why are we finding it everywhere? Why is it in our elementary schools?
Sarah.
Stacey,
I'm sorry.
No,
sorry.
I was like, where's Sarah?
Sarah, sorry.
I think it's important for the EPA to understand that the frustrating part for our community is that we had gotten the attention of a nonprofit, Edison Wetlands, from New Jersey, who came in to Indiana and spent tens of thousands of dollars on testing. The Indiana Department of Environmental Management back in 2017 had told the mayor, per the mayor telling us, that everything was fine. And so I think it's really important for them to understand that our frustration comes from, if Edison Wetlands had not come in and spent that money and we received hits above the acceptable levels, that we truly don't believe that Indiana Department of Environmental Management or the EPA would be testing at all at this point. And that's what we want to make sure that they understand, is that we've been talking about this. I mean, we were talking to Edison Wetlands for over a year before they actually tested, because they're pulling information. Where do we test? But we had been going to IDEM, the Department of Environmental Management. We have been going to local officials. And it's hard, because if Edison Wetlands had not stepped up, where would we be?
Jill and Tina, we're getting close to the end of the program here, but is it safe to say that at least some part of what you're going to be looking at here are ways to restore some confidence in the EPA and the way it communicates with the public and that people
certainly can we handle. Hope that is a benefit that would come from our work. And again, we are looking for the public's input at our meeting on Wednesday, May 8th at the Cultural Arts and Recreation Center at 396 Brannigan Boulevard in Franklin from 6 to 8 p.m. And we really want to hear from folks to help be able to make improvements to EPA or tell them where they're doing a good job. And so we look forward to hearing from folks and hopefully making the change that you all desire.
What are the other steps? I mean, I don't want to let you go beyond this meeting. What other things are you going to be looking at specifically?
So in addition to these meetings that we're holding with community members, we're really going and, you know, we're talking to EPA at all different levels, whether it's headquarters or the region or even the technical site contacts. And we're trying to get a sense of, you know, what's going on at the site. We're looking at documents related to sampling at the site. We're looking at the notifications that they have provided and when they've provided those notifications. So we're gathering a lot of information on all of the sites and trying to determine, you know, what the conditions are at the site and, you know, whether EPA has been communicating the sampling results and any other indicators that they have. Again, in a way that would allow the community to avoid exposure. So, you know, after we do these listening sessions, you know, we're going to, as a group, kind of look at what we've heard, not just in Franklin, Indiana, but in the other parts of the nation that we go and talk to the community. And we're going to see kind of what the issues that bubble up are and, you know, where it might make sense for EPA to make changes and, you know, areas where they may not necessarily be following things that they are required to, if that is the case. So we'll put that into a report, and that report will go to the EPA, and if there's recommendations, we make the recommendations to the EPA, and the EPA will have to provide a response to us whether they agree to take the actions necessary to address the recommendations or not.
Rebecca, you got about 30 seconds. Where's your reporting going to take you next on this issue?
You know, I'm really interested to hear what the OIG has to say, not only about the EPA, but I'm also very interested in what they have to say about the Indiana Department of Environmental Management and their role in this, if anything.
And that will have to be the last word. I would invite everybody, though, who's been a part of this discussion to continue it on our Facebook page. After we go off the air, our listeners and my guest, who are Carrie Reinhart, Stacy Davidson, Tina Lovengood, and Jill Trinosky, as well as our own Rebecca Thiel. I am John Kroll. You've been listening to No Limits. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks, John.
No Limits is a production of 90.1 WFYI Public Radio, Indianapolis. Producers, Sarah Neal Estes, Roxana Caldwell, and Jill Sheridan. Interactive Media Coordinator, Scott McAllister. Technical Producers, Cedric Freeman and Chris Flood. And Board Engineer, Joe Hatcher. Emily Matheny screens our calls. No Limits is made available through IPBS, Indiana's public broadcasting stations.